geospatial big data, software architecture, and the role of APIs in a standardized environment by Ingo Simmons of the Open Geospatial Consortium.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I'm glad to see that not everybody has moved out for lunch. So I'm complimenting pretty much Martin's talk, and I give you more the kind of 30,000 feet bird's view perspective on geospatial, and I will emphasize a bit more on the big data aspects, whereas Martin gave you all the dirty details about coordinate reference systems and moving from one to the other. So when we talk about geospatial data, I mean, most of our spatial data is pretty big data. And we see that lots of Apache projects are implementing parts of it, parts of the handling of geospatial data. So this morning we saw the keynote on the streaming aspects. We will see further down the week more presentations on all the different handlings of all those massive data sets. But what we don't see very much, and what I would like to, that's why I would like to give this talk here and to emphasize a bit more on, is there's little coordination of the spatial implementations across all those Apache projects. And being a member of a open geospatial consortium standardization organization, I would like to emphasize a bit more on the increase of interoperability by the usage of open standards. Let me talk briefly about architectures, integrating big data services, and the geospatial aspect of them. So if you look at Earth observations, we do have very big initiatives like BIDI, the Big Earth Data Initiative in the US, or we have the Sentinel program in Europe, where the European Commission has sent up quite a number of birds that are working and basically observing this planet. And we see that the volume of the data that comes from the Sentinel program is going up quite intensively. And we need to figure ways how to process all this data in a very efficient way. So this here is the Sentinel program plus Landsat. And you see all the Sentinels, the 51A, B, and so on. And you see that we are getting very quickly into the petabyte areas and still need to process all of that. In terms of commercial cloud hosting, we do have quite a number of commercial providers hosting data and providing processing capabilities. Digital Globe is a good example. They have a roughly 45 petabyte Earth observation data archive. Harris has a huge, what they call NV processing suite for geospatial data. Google Earth, I mean, you're probably all aware of it, roughly 5 petabytes of storage. Lots of library functions, but limiting factor here is a bit, how to pull data from one cloud into the other, how to process data. Huge amounts of data that is stored in distributed environments. Hexagon is another provider in the geospatial market, doing lots of cloud hosted dynamic services, Airbus and so on, experimenting with Hexagon services, parts of it in the Amazon cloud. Why is geo so important? Well, if you look at geo-enrichment, for example, and the opportunity to append data to a single record. So if you do have questions like, what are the property attributes to this insured property? What are the demographic group specific customer belongs to? What are the businesses connected to a certain area? You always have a simple single point somewhere on the planet, and you can attach so many elements to it. So this location becomes a very kind of, a pool of information, a source of information, in fact. And then you can run all those geoanalytics against those elements. If you look, for example, at the mobile phone market, you can figure out, what is the average network coverage you have in the area, and is your coverage better or worse than that of the competitors you have? Or do you have people within a certain area or moving out of areas? And there are lots of analytical functions we can run. And for quite a number of these functions, you need to integrate various technologies we see in the Apache domain. So we have all those streams coming in, but on the other side, we have all those massive data sets from the Earth observation providers. And often we want to integrate both of them. So how do we do that? The car is talking more and more to each other. I mean, this is still a bit futuristic, but we are getting there, and we are producing lots of gigabytes every hour if those cars start communicating with each other. And it's all geospatial, right? They are on our roads. Same with the network coverage and performance for the 3G, 4G, 5G networks. You want to improve your network. You want to give your prime customers the best experience. You want to reduce the churn rate. You want to get new customers subscribing to your cell phone service. And loyalty with cell phone service is pretty low. All this geospatial aspect gives you a very much layered information stack. So if you look at the demographics, for example, you get some sort of a map or basically a coverage of demographics in that area. And then you can start overlaying this with all sorts of other elements, like the street network, the area boundaries, business data you have, and what's not. I mean, there are lots and lots of different data sets we would like to overlay to make sure that we have the best information at a specific location or for a specific area. The insurance market is a very good example. If we do have, let's say, the houses, you have the water bodies, we have the topography, we have the rain observation network, then we can figure out what is the risk of a flooding for a specific house. And you can understand if a flooding that was reported was kind of realistic or not, so you have fraud detection built in. Lots of aspects where we need to integrate different data sets. And here you see the element Martin emphasized so much this morning. If we overlay all those different data sets and we have 3 kilometer offsets between the individual data sets, well, this house will end up somewhere in the water. And that doesn't work, right? We need to make sure that whatever data set we are laying on top of each other, we are on the same spot in on the planet. There are other elements of geospatial processing that take quite immense computing power. So if we look at land scan data, for example, and we want to figure out the population density or settlement mapping on a global resolution. And that is a typical example here, satellite imagery. We ran a feature detection algorithm on it. And you see its accuracy is pretty good. Oops, that jumped a bit. And that was done for Addis Ababa, for example, in Ethiopia. And it was in roughly 800 square kilometer area. And that is then performing within 27 seconds on a not overarching powerful machine with a pretty good quality of about 90%+ for the detection of all the settlements. And this is just settlement detection, and you can run this for all other elements you may find, right? Like the number of agricultural land was heavily overcalculated before. About, well, our old calculations roughly 15 years ago stated that there's far more arable land available than actually is. So the newer analysis of the new data we do have from all those different satellites provided much better information that helps us to much better understand the reality in the various countries and the to address elements like food security, for example. And with all those powerful machines, and we are now able to run rather complex workflows, and the first providers have already set up infrastructure that allow us to upload different algorithms to their platform, run it on their data, and then derive new knowledge from that. Well, this is, for example, an experiment done by, by Pitney Bowes. They had 170 million addresses, and they want to figure out, well, what are the closest 3 fire stations and the nearest water body? And that was a calculation where we have a workflow where we have multiple steps like point and polygon analysis, multiple times in fact, proximity analysis, all those geospatial processing algorithms. And it just took about 6 hours to produce that. Ecology is another domain where we see lots of the integration of all those different data sets. And given that we have lots of unsupervised multi-rank clustering here in the ecology sector, it's pretty important that we can overlay all those different data elements in a very efficient way. And the elements that go into such an ecological clustering map are, for example, the temperatures. Here we just have an example like days below freezing, but you have even very hot days, very cold days, duration of summer month, duration of the growing period, amount of water, the precipitation, amount of that includes then snow and rain, long snow or rain periods. I mean, lots of different factors that are pretty important to understand the ecological domains. And then from there, you can derive all sorts of other very important elements, like how does this map develop with the ongoing climate change? And what does it mean for the area? What does it mean for the area of Sevilla and around us if climate changes towards much longer dry periods in summer? Can we still afford growing tomatoes out here or not because of the amount of water is not available anymore? And the big data analysis here really allows us to understand the different scenarios in a very efficient and very, in a very efficient manner. Transportation is another area where we see lots of even in-time development. In-time processing, so to understand the current traffic congestion situation, or even to optimize the road networks, to optimize the traffic light settings, to make sure that all the streams of people getting in and out of town, depending on the time of the day, is really optimized. We do have very high precision locations now, given all those GPS-enabled phones we do have, and we can extract the location from the phones directly. So we're not bound any longer to cell phone or cell tower information. No, it's getting real actual information from the GPS devices. We can understand if we can pack more people into a single car, we can, well, eventually go towards fully automatic cars here. So lots of elements where we do have the opportunity to use geospatial data. Marketing is a very big element for sure as well. I mean, in the past, we used the behavior. We tried to understand what our customers want, their behavior patterns, where do they shop, what do they buy. Nowadays, we try to integrate more and more context elements and try to figure out what are the possibilities. And we want to get to the more predictive market that we can adapt much better. And all this is summarized under the location-based marketing umbrella. It's not only big areas like ecological mapping or so. It's even the city models for the smart cities. We are now participating in quite a number of projects with smart cities, and every second city seems to be a smart city these days, which just means that they're integrating lots of different data sets, and we see more and more cities providing very high level of detail data sets for the entire city. This is an example from Berlin here, where we have level of detail 4, so that means you have all the roof structures, you have all the windows, and you have basically, it looks like, if you zoom out a little bit more, it looks like a photograph. And that's roughly 500,000 buildings here. New York has about roughly 1 million buildings, a little bit lower level of detail, so we would just see the blocks of houses, not necessarily the roof structures or the windows, but nevertheless, and that is continuously growing, and in particular, with all the microsatellites and all the drones we are bringing out now with the laser scanning, those are produced more and more. So a couple of years' time, we will have highly realistic city models from quite a number of cities. And then the question is, where do we store these? What kind of technologies do we use to integrate data from the various city models? How can we easily compare city models that are operated and processed by different systems? Lots of elements that that need to be addressed. There are quite a number of standards available, and Martin just before already mentioned quite a number of them. So for location, geometry, you mentioned the features, we have coverages, and I will talk very briefly about these. But when we start with the power of location, we have the first law of geography. Who's aware of the first law of geography? Well, that's good. Basically, everything is related to everything else, right? I mean, this is related to that, it's related to that, and so on. But things that are closer together are more related than distant things. And if you think about it, that's what we, that's our conceptual model that we reflect, that we see reflected every day. And the interesting thing is that we can, from understanding what the current situation is and from understanding how the past looked like, we can give very good predictability for the, we can really show that we know to a very high extent how the future will look like in some of these areas. That's a very, very powerful concept. And now I think I can probably skip quite a number of slides because Martin already addressed this. I mean, this is the peculiarity is about spatial. That is like planet Earth is always shown on the nice photographs. It's a perfectly round shape when we know it's not flat, but it looks flat. And then we get into the dirty details with the geoid here, and then we'll, the latitude, longitude elements. I think I can skip that because Montaigne just showed it to us. But key element here is latitude is not unique, longitude is not unique, depending on where you are and depending on what reference system you use, you may end up in trouble. That's why standardization bodies like the OGC or ISO came up with lots of coordinate reference systems, stadiums and coordinate systems, serializations. So whatever organizations like EPSG have done to collect all those elements about the datum, the reference system, the coordinates, that can be all expressed. And if we talk about exchanging data through those different Apache projects, we certainly have to remember all these elements, and very glad that Martin already emphasized this morning. Because that's what it looks like, right? We have a very familiar shaped continent, though this is just a face here, and depending on what kind of projection you use, you have very interesting distortion effects. So one element on a map may look completely different. So here's an even easier to understand example, though that is typically a Mercator projection. You see that Africa is a bit bigger than Southern America, and Europe is, if you take entire Europe from, Spitzbergen is somewhere here until Southern Spain, it appears that Europe is almost the size of Africa. If you go into a different projection, it looks completely different, right? Suddenly, South America is by far the largest, together with Asia. Africa has shrunk a bit, but even more, Europe has shrunk dramatically. Latin America looks quite interesting, but both are right or wrong, right? I mean, there is no real right or wrong here. It's just about a matter of how do we get the three-dimensional sphere into a flat two-dimensional representation. And that is so important, and Martin has emphasized the errors already. So we do have deviations, or what we call undulations, between the geoid and the, for example, WGS84 ellipsoid. And those are quite important in some areas. Same with sea level. If you go on a boat cruise and you cross an ocean, the average sea level you would expect on your GPS is probably zero, right? Because you're just on the water. But it's not. It's varying. If you see the planet Earth, I mean, it's not really a perfect sphere. because of the different gravity masses in the core of the planet. We see that even the oceans have kind of dens and so on. And what does it mean for the actual altitude of specific elements? Well, what you usually do is you use a tide gauge system, and in Europe we pretty often use, at least in Germany and the Netherlands, we use the Amsterdam tide gauge. And what we do use, what we do is, we do measure for about 10 years what the average tide is, and then we do a leveling, right? You see all those guys with the sticks in their hand, the leveling meters, and then you just go across the country and you try to figure out, well, what are the leveling lines and what needs to be compared to what? The problem appears once you have different tide gauge systems. So this, for example, is the border between Belgium and the Netherlands. And you see that although this is the 30-meter line here, well, here it is again, 30-meter line, and it stops here because there's a gap between almost 2.5 meters between the Netherlands and Belgium. So Belgium is much higher than the Netherlands, right? I mean, you would not expect that you need to jump down from here to there 2.5 meters if you cross the border, but if you look on the maps, they are different. And if you try to overlay data from those different systems, just things that we need to keep in mind. So without the metadata, without all those geodetic elements and dirty details about map projections, don't think about exchanging data. It only causes problems. And we need to keep this in mind when we look at the exchange mechanism between different systems. Yeah, I put this slide in here, but Will has shown to us the elements. So let's go a bit back to the geospatial information. What we see is we roughly have four main elements. We do have the feature data that are our real-world elements, our streets, our houses, our rivers, our forests. Whatever you see is a feature. It's an abstraction of a real-world entity. You can use any entity you like. Then we can represent this either on a pixel base, and we have a kind of like a typical image you get from your cameras, and you have a raster representation, or you have a vector representation, where you basically have the polygonal structures, and then you can represent this nicely as a maps or as metadata. And to get all of this standardized, the OGC has started with a thing called simple features. And simple features abstract from the real-world objects and create something that has a geometry. So a simple feature is nothing but a thing with geometry. And the geometry can be anything between a point, a curve, or a surface. And then you can construct all sorts of combinations, right? Your road might be a line string, your area might be a polygon, you have multi-polygons, so that's, for example, a lake with an island in there, and so on. And these simple features really help us to identify key elements and then enrich all those elements we do have with the various data sets we have access to. And then it becomes a bit nasty again because we start about topological relationships between things. And as long as we are in the realm of two polygons, that's pretty simple. Well, this is one of the approaches. There are different approaches how topological relationships are modeled. And this is a very simple one. So you have two areas, and if they touch, well, all of us have a pretty similar conceptual model of what that means. It gets very nasty and dirty if we think about lines. And if we do a test within the room here, we all have different understandings of what those things should be called, right? And if you think about topological relationships and processing of immense data sets within different systems and then trying to arrange things, those elements or those aspects have to be taken into account. There are powerful query languages, so GeoSparkle, for example, if you want to get all those topological relationships, well, you can find things. You can find all the houses along a specific road. You can find all the lakes within a specific area. You can find even very complex things, houses along a road with other elements attached to it. It all boils down to the idea of the geographic features. So we do have our abstract models, we have the conceptualization of the world, and then we generate all those implementations. So that's basically what it looks like, right? We do have a road, we create our model of that road, and then we serialize it in whatever format we like. And in order to get exchange between various systems, or in order to integrate all those different data sets, we have developed quite a number of exchange languages, and the geography markup language, GML, is just one example of those exchange languages. And then we can go from the outdoor even into the indoor. So the idea is that we have, for example, city GML and indoor GML. One provides you the topography, so the space model of a house. And then if you place sensors within the house, you need to have a model that allows you to walk around, find your way. Last night I arrived pretty late at Barcelona Airport. I was looking for the hotel, which is supposed to be at Terminal 1. Try find it. No way, without calling them. Yeah. And things like that, right? How do we express elements? I mean, one organization has the topography of Barcelona Airport Terminal 1, for example, and the other one is the hotel, where the other one provides the indoor navigation system. So how do we get from A to B? How do we integrate all of these? And there are standards available supporting these elements. Moving features is another very important element. We have lots of moving features, right? All those cars moving around, people moving around, the traffic situation, people with cell phones in networks. And the idea is to understand what a element that is moving in space can do. So from this timestamp to that timestamp, what is a possible trajectory that the element can take? When do we see two trajectories crossing or likely to cross, and so on. So the moving features, and that goes pretty much into the stream processing realm, are extremely important. Just that if we do have two moving features analyzed and developed by two different systems, trying to understand if trajectories really cross means that we have to understand all those reference systems between the two elements and the two data providing systems. So if you go into stream processing, integration of elements coming from diverse systems, well, there are lots of geospatial particularities to be considered. Same with social media. We see more and more requirements from our funding organizations to integrate all sorts of social media, then extract locations of all those messages or images sent, and then bring them on maps and integrate all of this. And in the ideal world, even link between all those elements, right? This pretty much goes into the semantic web and linked data realm. Geospatial coverages. So this is typical satellite imagery. And just to give you a short impression of what we can do and need to do with it. So eventually it's just pixels in this situation here. And those pixel grids can then be used with some thematic layering. And this, for example, is ecological pixel grid with urban fields in red and grassland in green and cropland and different types of forests. But it's not necessarily just an image, right? This is a wind field coverage where we do see the speed and direction of wind for specific points in that coverage. We can have the tints the network that allow us to do all the topography modeling, trying to understand where the water, the rain fall flows to, so we can calculate flow directions and so on. And one element that creates more and more data are the point clouds, where we do have, in particular, laser scanning or radar, for example, producing lots and lots of points that then need to be converted into a model of the area. So bathymetry, for example, what are the depths of the water in the various areas, calculated just by billions of points, is a very important workflow. And even for these elements, there are new working groups. I can skip that, I guess. And they all help to support the geospatial analytics. So we have more and more algorithms to integrate all those elements. We have more and more data that needs to be integrated. But we need to be sure that the data is really at the same location, or, well, at least we know that it is or is not, and we understand its topology. Otherwise, the integration and the processing of all the data becomes pretty messy. If we look then at all the data we have different mechanisms to index all our data, so there are just a number of indexing techniques. And if you look at some of the Apache projects, we see quite a number of different spatial indexing mechanisms and approaches, most of them kind of representing a discrete global grid system where we do have a tessellation of cells covering the entire planet, and then we can provide an index for each of these cells and can go to any level of detail. And this approach helps us to identify each location with a single one-dimensional index. And that is pretty powerful, because once we have mapped our location to one of these cells, we can easily exchange information about a single cell without worrying too much about all those coordinate reference systems and so on, because then we are at a single index and not any longer at a geospatial location. And if you look at those discrete global grid systems, I mean, we have different types or different shapes for all those cells. We can have square cells. We're pretty familiar with them, because most of our maps start pretty much with square cells. We can have triangular ones, hexagonal, and so on. But common to all of these is that you do have an index. You just walk from one cell to the other, and then you just create your index based on all those cells, and that really helps us to integrate all sorts of different data sets. So everything you have here, and you have different space-filling curves, you create your index, and then you just have a very nice, easily processable index mechanisms for your different locations. We just need to agree on the space-filling curves, and as you can imagine, there are endless numbers of space-filling curves, so just make sure you understand how the index is created, and then it's pretty easy to overlay different data sets. Another aspect that is pretty important is a sensor web. So we do have more and more sensors. So sensors everywhere, with those billions of devices that are projected for 2020. They all provide new insights into our geospatial world, and we need to integrate them. And there are quite a number of standards available here as well, particularly the OGC sensor web, where that supports the discovery of sensors, the integration of sensor data, the tasking of sensors. OGC sensor things for the Internet of Things, where the idea is, well, we do have so many sensors that are constantly providing streams of data, and we need to integrate them, while taking into account that we do have geospatial elements here. And the interesting element about those standards is that they really fit into each other. So even the tiny little sensor that provides some whatever traffic density readings, for example, can be annotated with this feature of interest thing that provides us the geometry according to the simple features we have seen before. So we have those layered elements, we have those core standards, and then we can build on top of these core standards even elements for the Internet of Things. And if we summarize those important elements, we basically see that we have a number of essentials and, for example, the simple features I've shown before, the well-known text and the well-known binary to encode all those location aspects that we have even seen in Martin's presentation before, the filtering mechanisms, how to filter only these data sets out of this big data bubble that you're interested in, and quite some other elements. It's all documented from the geo perspective in a big data white paper, and what we need to do, and what I'm trying to do here in this week, is pretty much understanding the Apache perspective on all those geospatial aspects, how it is handled, how it is taken into account. So if we look at the use cases for big data, and we have the two sides. One is the observation side, where we do have all the sensors, and the other one is the users and consumer side. We roughly see four major columns. One is the ingesting side, so all those sensors or social media platforms that provide tons of data at very high frequencies. All the very small satellites that are flying around, the big ones producing petabytes of data. So the ingestion side is very important. It has lots of geospatial elements in it. Then we have the analytics side, which we have seen before, right, where we do have all those spatio-temporal analysis, what is where and when and where it does it might be in future. We need to integrate all those different sensor types we do have from the tiny little sensor on the ground with the satellite sensor, and they are all in different systems. It's not that we can just put them all into a single system. That will always be provided by different providers, different space organizations, commercial providers, and so on. Do all those geospatial databases, trying to understand the snapshots of the world. And then we have the spatial modeling, where we do have all those forecasting and environment models, and so on. And if we project this to the Apache community, we see quite a number of Apache projects. And to figure out the timing here, we should probably go through them a bit quicker. But there are lots of different Apache projects, and they all have those geospatial elements to it. And I still need to better understand how the geospatial aspects need to be modeled and can be modeled. But it's pretty important even for us as a standardization organization to understand, well, what are the components that we need to standardize? What do we need to do to support all those Apache projects in their work with geospatial data to make sure once they go into the exchange mode, we do have elements coming out of a stream processor, for example, getting into a big data analysis tool. How can we make sure that all those geospatial aspects are addressed well and efficiently? So same for the databases, the spatial modeling. They're all addressed. A few words about the Open Geospatial Consortium. It is founded in 1994. It has roughly 520-something member organizations at the moment. It's pretty much all areas from the commercial sector, government, universities, research, and NGOs. The focus is certainly North America and Europe, but there are a growing number of Asian Pacific organizations being member. Middle East is growing. Africa is still rather small, as is South America. The idea is to standardize everything that has to do with geospatial, and it is not the OGC defining what needs to be standardized. Really, the members bringing those ideas into the process. That's why I'm here as well, trying to understand what's required from the Apache community to be addressed. And then we do have different programs. One is the standardization program, developing the standards, and then we see lots of implementations and alliances with other standard organizations to make sure everything works well. We started Geospatial Track at the Big Data Conference in May in the US, where my colleague George talked about open geospatial standards. And we had quite a number of talks drawing geospatial elements. Spark is a geospatial analytics engine. Spark again, Mesos, we have SkySpark, Hadoop Accumulo, and other applications with location projects. Martin, you talked about elements of geospatial complexity, querying with Apache Momota, and so on. So there is a discussion slowly getting off the ground, and I would really appreciate if we could continue this discussion here during the week. Next elements, we do have a major testbed coming up where big data plays a role, cloud computing plays a role, analytics of data streams plays a role. What we do in those testbeds is we collect money from sponsoring organizations and redistribute the money across our membership. And I'm pretty sure if you look at the website, opengeospatial.org, you directly find the testbed 13. And there are lots of elements where you can certainly have Apache projects being part of such a testbed. Just an example, the ESA exploitation platforms, ESA with all those sentinels and Landsats and whatnot satellites up there, is currently trying to understand the best way of processing all these data sets. Same is true for NASA. I mean, basically all the space organizations are exploring mechanisms because sharing the data is not an option anymore, as we have seen with this huge amount. And if we integrate all of this into a single architecture, then what we see is we do have more and more sensors from somewhere down in the ocean up to satellites flying way above us. We have all those other sources which have been already aggregated and developed over the last decades. And in terms of, for example, cell phone usage data or so on, those are constantly updated at very, very high frequencies. All of this needs to be integrated. So this gives us a very complex data layer already. We have a big processing, analytics, and storage layer that needs to make use of all those sensing devices. We have lots of exploitation platforms that produce even lots of algorithms already that are prepackaged that needs to be integrated. And the question is, how do we get all of this together in a way that whatever application we have can make use of standardized formats? And we have lots of, well, elements here in between, like messaging, orchestration, discovery services, linked data, catalogs, how to find all those elements, how to make sure an application developer is not seeing all the complexity of the data processing, of the data generation down here, but what are the APIs that we need, what are the standardized services that we need so that I can use geospatial data, even heavily processed geospatial data, without being an expert in Jive, Hadoop, Spark, and Co. All right, that's about it. If you have some time, just check opengeospatial.org. You find all those standards, all the approaches, all the base models. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention. And if you have any questions, let me know. Thank you.
Any questions? No?
Well, standards are really nice, and when you have open data, adopting an open standard is a really good idea.
Yep.
But as a business, we have to operate with a lot of closed data. Right. It turns out, especially for indoors, every company has their own standard. Mm-hmm. Nobody respects what you said. So it's really difficult. So I'm just really happy you're doing this work. And I wonder, other people who are doing open data and trying to do their own standards, like OpenStreetMap, they have a completely different indoors representation. They don't have one either. They have three or so.
Right.
And honestly, all of them suck in one way or another, right? So what are you doing to promoting the adoption of these standards?
Yeah, we are interacting with quite a number of organizations that need the processing results or need the systems within, reflecting to the indoor systems you're referencing. Well, this is a rather new market, and we have seen the same situation in other markets before, and it took decades sometimes to get them integrated. And I'm not sure to which extent we will ever integrate them fully, right? We will ever have the competing approaches. But at least we are trying with the organization that then run all those procurements to make sure that the standards become part of the procurement language, to make sure when we have larger systems that standards become an essential part. And if you look at in Europe, for example, with the Open Data Act, I mean, more and more of governmental data needs to be or shall be published as open data. We're getting there. It's a very slow process. If you look at Inspire, for example, the infrastructure in Europe, it's a slow process. It takes more than 10 years. But we're getting there slowly, but constantly. And if we talk about businesses that trying to create their own standards, even these businesses, and with the business I even mean the military market as well, they're opening stepwise because they figure out that they don't have the resources available anymore to do everything their way. So they're even opening to the civil market and trying to adapt what is available there. But you're right, it's a long way to really get there.
Thanks.
Any other questions? No? Well, let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you.
And that's it.